Well, in part by a grant from The Great Impasta, a restaurant serving foods from northern Italy. The Great Impasta is at 114 West Church in Champaign. The staff at The Great Impasta encourage you to join them in supporting WILL AM 580.
Programming on WILL is made possible in part by Krannert Center for the Performing Arts. The 2006-2007 schedule of music, dance, opera, and theatrical events at Krannert Center is available by contacting the Krannert Center ticket office or visiting krannertcenter.com.
It's 106. This is the Afternoon Magazine on WILL. We have a program now, an interview show from the AM 580 Afternoon Magazine archives. So because this is a taped program, we are not taking phone calls today.
This is the Afternoon Magazine on WILL AM 580 and online at WILL.UIUC.edu. Good afternoon, I'm Celeste Quinn. Thanks for joining us today. One of the most controversial issues in our public schools is sex education, and our guest this afternoon is sociologist Kristen Luker, and she has spent 20 years talking with educators, parents, and others about if and how sex ed should be part of the curriculum. She's the author of four books. Her latest is When Sex Goes to School, Warring Views on Sex and Sex Education Since the 60s. For the study that led to this book, Kristen Luker spent a great deal of time interviewing people and attending school board and committee meetings of various groups in four communities around the country. She wanted answers to several questions, which she lists early in her book, When Sex Goes to School. How did sex education, which has been surprisingly common for the better part of a century and which has enjoyed very high levels of public support for most of that time, come to be so controversial? What is it about sex education that makes people so passionate about it? And what is it that translates that passion into politics at the national level? Let me tell you a bit more about our guest. Kristen Luker is a professor of sociology at the University of California, Berkeley, where she also holds an appointment in the School of Law. Her previous books include Dubious Conceptions, The Politics of the Teenage Pregnancy Crisis, and Abortion and the Politics of Motherhood. Her new book, When Sex Goes to School, is published by W.W. Norton. Kristen Luker, thank you so much for joining us this afternoon.
It's my pleasure, Celeste. Thanks for asking me.
Oh, my pleasure to talk with you. What a fascinating line of work you're in.
It is. It's never boring.
Yeah. And sex education isn't new. It's been around for the better part of a century. So how did it begin?
Well, it began before World War I, and it began among people that were reformers of many sorts. They tried to make playgrounds. They tried to help the poor. They tried to help what they called working girls. But one of the core things that they saw as problematic was the issue of sex. And it seems to me that sex worried them because, for whatever reasons, the use of contraception was becoming much more common. It isn't as though there were any technological breakthroughs, but just people were using it more. And they were using it more because there was a shift in what people expected and wanted from marriage and from families. So these early sex educators thought that it was their job to sort of manage this shift and teach people about this shift. And so from the very beginning, sex education was really family life education. A lot of people think that family life education is just a euphemism for sex education, but the family life part of sex education was, you know, bred into the bones of early sex education.
Okay, what was early sex education like, and how has it changed over time?
Well, it basically, probably if you're over 45, it's something you'll remember, which is it basically warns people about the dangers of sex before marriage. It told them the values of healthy sex within marriage. The dilemma that the early sex educators confronted, that people still confront, is how do you tell people not to have sex and then all of a sudden to have wonderful sex as soon as you get married? And so they saw their goal really as twofold. One, to warn people against premarital and extramarital sex, but the other, to help do those kinds of things that would help husbands and wives appreciate each other and become better sexually adjusted. Now, they didn't actually get down to what you and I would consider the real nitty-gritty, but what they did was they proposed, and in this they both created and reflected the changes going on in the larger society, a new vision of marriage, which was, and a new vision of sexuality, by the way, which was an intimate, comradely partnership between a man and a woman who deeply loved each other and who expressed that love through their sexuality. Older models of sexuality had been that sexuality was something men wanted and women put up with because they got these wonderful children out of it. Now, again, I want to stress that that's a cultural ideal. I'm sure there were plenty of women and men, for that matter, in the 1880s who knew perfectly well that sex could be a pleasure. But the cultural ideal, the cultural expectation was that women were really only interested in maternity and weren't interested in sex. So the new cultural ideal that these sex educators, who called themselves social hygienists, were promoting was this model of kind of a partnership, actually a model that we still, by and large, take for granted, that men and women in a marriage can be each other's best friends, that sexuality has to be good for both of them, that no partner can impose it on the other partner, that it's a source of intimacy and closeness, and that people also have children, but it's not tightly tied to sexuality.
And now, though, we've been through the 1960s, and you say men and women of a certain age have lived through a revolution that will in the end be as historic as the American, French, or Russian revolutions.
I really believe that, Celeste, and I think mostly because we lived through it, we don't quite recognize that yet. But I talk about in the book that as late as 1965, whatever people did in their private lives, there was a strongly held set of consensual values throughout the society as a whole, that good people didn't have sex before marriage, good people didn't cheat on their spouses, good people didn't have homosexual relationships, and they didn't have abortions. And those latter two were mostly encoded through silences. I don't think anybody ever said to their kids, oh, homosexuality is bad or abortion is bad, but just the fact that nobody talked about it, it was really quite invisible. And in one of my previous books, I discovered that through the 1960s, newspapers here in California actually wouldn't print the word abortion. They would print illegal operation. So that kind of sexuality was, or that model of sexuality was shared throughout the society as a whole. And by 1972, just a few short years later, the number of people who were opposed to premarital sex had dropped 20 percentage points. The number of people who were opposed to abortion had dropped significantly. And this was before Roe v. Wade, mind you. The number of people who thought that teenagers should get contraception expanded dramatically. And I think the key thing, and why I think it was so revolutionary, is that it was tied to a different model, again, as the first sex education was, to a different model of how men and women were supposed to relate to each other.
Is the revolution over?
Well, interesting question. My colleague Arlie Hochschild, when she speaks about the gender part of it, calls it a stalled revolution, that we got part of the way but not all of the way. And that sounds right to me in certain ways, and you know, I'd be happy to talk about that more. But concretely, yes, in the sense that young people today are completely, completely is probably not the right word, but they're accepting of homosexuality. Homosexuality is on primetime TV. About half of all married couples live together before they get married. The majority of teenagers will be sexually active before they reach their 21st birthday. So, yes, there is a very dramatic change. And, you know, if I may say, the most interesting change that came through the interviews, these other changes I know from statistical data and from historical data, but the change that really hit home for me when I was analyzing the interviews is that women of my age, I'm in my late 50s, the women whom I interviewed, both those who opposed and who favored sex education, talked about their mothers and fathers teaching them that men were the enemy, that men wanted just one thing, and that men would, say in West Side Story, they'll take your love and leave you crying, you know? And I think that what's happened since the 70s is there's been a sort of equalization of men and women such that sex and virginity isn't a precious resource that men are trying to take away from women and women are trying to hold to bargain for marriage. And that was, I think, the most striking change that I heard in all my interviews.
What about the older generation, the generation that would have been your parents and my parents? Did their attitudes shift at all during this revolution, the 60s and 70s?
Oh, they certainly did. And oddly enough, I think their behavior shifted as a result of the that first sexual revolution in the before World War I. And that first sexual revolution, in some part, was and the response of the social hygienists was in some part designed to deal with premarital sex. With better contraception, there was much more premarital sex, particularly in among the kind of people who became social hygienists. But it was a very special kind of premarital sex. And I think, again, we've lost the fact that there's been a revolutionary change because we use the same term. And that is the premarital sex that my parents or your parents engaged in, if they did, was with their fiancé. It was a few months before the marriage, and it was what we might call engagement sex. But young people today face on average, about a decade from the time that they become sexually active to the time that they marry. And if you break it out racially, it's even longer for African-American young men and women because rates of marriage are so low.
Hmm. Let's talk a little bit more about that, and then maybe we can come back to, you know, the revolution. Maybe the revolution is over, but there's plenty of skirmishes.
Oh, yes, and I think there's part of what the book is about is that there's a well-organized and hard-working counter-revolution going on.
Yeah, well, we can talk about, let's come back to that. But I want to talk about how premarital sex has changed, the experience of that has changed since the 60s, the 70s. And in the book, you say, you know, at least part of the reason sex education is in the limelight today is that we see American teenagers as not handling their sexuality very well. And then you note that American teens aren't any more likely to be sexually active than their peers in Europe, but the consequences are very different here than in Europe. Would you talk about that?
Well, yes. It surprises people because most Americans who haven't studied it intensively think that somehow our teenagers either start younger or more of them have sex. But, you know, although they're differences between individual countries, by and large, teenagers in industrialized countries start sex at about the same age and roughly in the same proportions, order of magnitude. But teenagers in Europe don't get pregnant as often as ours do. We have one of the highest abortion rates for teenagers and, if I may say, for adults in the industrialized world. They don't pass on sexually transmitted diseases to each other. They seem to handle their sexuality, at least in terms of the things that we might worry about in terms of public health, in a much better way. I did some interviews in both Sweden and in France, and it was my impression that teenage sexuality just wasn't such a big deal, either for adults or teenagers. You know, it was just, you know, just something you did. And that struck me as being very, very different from the situation here in the United States.
That's un-American.
It's un-American?
Yeah.
Well, yes, and you know, Celeste, I came to the sort of gloomy conclusion that Europe is going to look more like America rather than vice versa. I think most professional sex educators hope that if they just work hard enough and get enough good curricula and information out there, we'll begin to look more and more like the Europeans. But my hunch is the Europeans are going to look more and more like Americans. And the reason for that is I don't think it's anything about the sex ed programs that they have in Europe, but rather that most countries in Europe have historically been what we sociologists call monocultures, meaning everybody is roughly the same ethnic background, everybody more or less is the same religion, that in a way we're kind of like sexuality was in the United States in the 1950s. People pretty much agree on what sex is, who should do it, how you should do it, what your responsibilities are. But with the very large influx of guest workers and migrants of other ethnicities, and in particular other religions, and I'm thinking specifically of Muslim immigrants, I think sexuality and education about it is very likely to become a political hotspot in Europe in the future. And then it's at least possible that the Swedes and the French and the Danes and the Germans will kind of look to America and say, how have these people dealt with this really controversial issue?
Hmm. Well, we're at odds about it.
Oh, deeply.
Yeah,
we are deeply at odds. And in fact, we're so deeply at odds. Now, remember, the structure of the way I did the research is I talked to people who were either passionately opposed to what's now being called comprehensive sex education, and most of them were in favor of something that's now being called abstinence education, or I talked to people who were passionately in favor of comprehensive education. So I didn't talk to the person in the street. You know, I'm really talking about the leaders and the movers and the shakers and the people who are going to be involved in a community fight about sex education. And my logic was that in some sense you get the purest case if you talk to the most passionate people. And I was so convinced, tying back to our conversation about a revolution that took place in the 1960s, that I've concluded that they're sexual liberals and sexual conservatives, and they're just as much at each other's throats as political liberals and political conservatives. And the two categories don't neatly overlap. They tend to, but they're not a one-to-one fit.
Yeah. Now, this is a topic that you take up in depth in the chapter Boundaries, Life, and the Whole Darn Thing. What are the views on boundaries? And what do you mean by boundaries, first of all? That's a good place to start. And what are the views on boundaries held by conservatives?
Well, sometimes when I talk about the book, I say this book is a historical story, a political story, and then, in the end, an emotional story. Because what struck me were the differences between these sexual liberals and sexual conservatives were very deep, maybe even temperamental, different views about the world. What I meant by boundaries, for example, would be that the sexual conservatives think there's a clear distinction between young people and older people. And one of the things that I'm struck by, as having studied the controversy for 20 years, is how the young people we're talking about are becoming younger and younger in discussion. So increasingly, we find ourselves, and I've even done it, talking about children. But usually when we're talking about sexually active young people, we're usually talking about people fairly far along in adolescence. The roughly the median age of sexual debut, as we sociologists call it and demographers call it, is in the neighborhood of 16, which means half of the kids haven't been sexually active by 16. So we're talking about people who are in high school, their later years of high school, maybe even have graduated from high school. And yet, we've come to talk about them as quote-unquote children. That would be an example. Liberals would think, well, you have children, you have young adolescents, you have middle adolescents, you have older adolescents, you have college-age people, you know, that there's a sort of a continuum, and somewhere along that line, an individual child shows by his or her behavior, and particularly his or her capacity to make good decisions, that he or she is ready to be sexually active. For sexual conservatives, there's a boundary, and it's marriage. If you're not married, you shouldn't be sexual.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Now, the boundaries, those boundaries, how are they viewed by liberals?
Well, liberals think, and it really was very remarkable. I think one of the reasons the two groups have such a hard time talking is that in some ways they have nothing in common, and in some ways they have so much in common.
Mm-hmm.
The liberals think that, you know, true to their heritage in the social hygiene movement, that that actually the best kind of sexuality is coupled, intimate, committed sexuality. They just don't think legal heterosexual marriage is the only place to have that. And they don't think it's the only kind of sex a person will have in a lifetime. That people will have puppy love, which may include sexuality. They may have brief affairs. They may do many things across their lifetimes. And yes, they have in their own mind's eye the idea that, you know, if you work really hard and you're really lucky, then you may end up in this kind of very intense emotional and satisfying sexuality. But that doesn't mean you can't have other kinds of sexuality in the meanwhile.
Mm. And these two groups, these two different worldviews, two views of human nature, you say that they are the people that are on either side of the debate or the divide. They do have something in common with one another. Is that the passion with which they...
Well, they have many things in common.
Okay.
They have, yes, they bring passion to it. They both think that a committed marriage, if I can use that word in such a way that it would include homosexuals, for the liberals and wouldn't include homosexuals for the conservatives, that a committed relationship is the best kind of sex. They tend to be very similar in background. They're not, you know, radically different. But they look at the world in these very, very different ways. One of the things I was struck by was their feelings about hierarchy, which is that the conservatives feel that old people should have power over young people, that, for example, men shouldn't necessarily have power over women, but they have very different kinds of lives, that they believe that expertise should have power over, you know, other kinds of values, which, by the way, puts them in a very funny position. So, you know, I say in the book that these conservatives, these sexual conservatives, make me think of an old-fashioned organizational flow chart, you know, when corporations had those with people reporting up the line. And the liberals make me think of one of these Japanese quality circles where everybody from the manager to the lowest mechanic works together on the same problem, bringing their own particular experience into the mix.
Okay, so a top-down versus network approach.
Yes, well said. Oh, that's exactly the right way to put it. It's sort of a web versus a hierarchy.
Hmm. This is the Afternoon Magazine, and our guest today is sociologist Kristen Luker. She is the author, most recently, of When Sex Goes to School, Warring Views on Sex and Sex Education Since the 60s. This is the Afternoon Magazine. My name is Celeste Quinn. Listeners, you can join us this afternoon with your questions, with comments for our guest. Join us with a telephone call. The number in the Champaign-Urbana area is 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. And toll-free number is 800-222-9455, 800-222-WILL. You went to four communities around the country. You call them Shady Grove, Billingsley, Lincoln Township, and Las Colinas.
Mm-hmm.
Can you give us some sense of where these communities are located and what the big ticket issues were in these communities?
Well, the communities were located in the Rust Belt East, although it was one of those communities where the affluent people would commute to the urban center, many of them, I may say, in limousines. But many other people found themselves, with their manufacturing jobs disappearing out from under them. Billingsley was in the Deep South, a very rural and agricultural area. And Shady Grove and Las Colinas were both on the West Coast. And both of them were in different ways. Lincoln Township was a suburb that was sort of falling apart into two different classes, then both Shady Grove and Billingsley were sort of rural areas. Shady Grove and Las Colinas were like Billingsley used to be, but a new class was moving in and turning that into a suburb. And the hot-button issues in every single community were the same, and they weren't the ones I expected. They were homosexuality and masturbation. And I expected, frankly, abortion to be much more of a hot, big ticket item, as you call it. And it's either because school teachers are sort of, very wary of taking on the issue, or the issue is, for all intents and purposes, or was when I was doing my research, people thought it was one way or another settled. But I guess I was sort of surprised that homosexuality and, in particular, masturbation were so alarming to parents.
Hmm. I would kind of suspect homosexuality would be.
I think I would, too, although I never quite got it. I never quite got why homosexuality was as distressing to the people who opposed comprehensive sex education as it is. And I, one thought was that it represented in people's imaginations, and this came out in the interview, all sexual pleasure and no sexual responsibility or no sexual duty.
Hmm.
The other one, this is not my insight, but the insight of a very smart sociologist named Janice Irvine, who's written a book called Talk About Sex, to the extent that at least some of these conservatives are born-again Christians, they've had the experience of their entire identity changing in a moment. So it seems very plausible to them that you could be a true blue heterosexual and change your identity as quickly as they changed their identity to a born-again person. And I thought that was a very insightful comment because the conservatives that I spoke of were just absolutely convinced that if young people even heard about homosexuality, they could be, as they would put it, recruited to the gay lifestyle. And I think the fact they call it gay lifestyle underlines my point about that they see it as pleasure and not responsibility. If think how different it would sound as if opponents said, they could be recruited to gay marriage. you know, and have to pay the mortgage and take out the garbage and do the things that every other married couple does. That doesn't sound so frightening somehow.
Well, that's very interesting, because the idea of pleasure without responsibility sort of flies in the face for the current climate for you know, among homosexuality, some homosexuals, that there is a push for being recognized in a committed relationship, pleasure
exactly
and
right.
responsibility.
Well, no, exactly right. That's yeah. exactly my point.
Yeah.
That it sounds very different to be recruited to a lifestyle than to be recruited to a marriage, but just your partners of a different sex than, you, well, of the same sex, I guess I should say.
So how do, maybe I'm not quite, maybe this quite hasn't sunk in yet for me. How do sexual conservatives view then the push for gay marriage?
Well, they oppose it because they think it legitimizes homosexuality. And since their core belief is that there's only one kind of sexuality, and that's in a marriage, open to getting pregnant, and between a man and a woman, that kind of excludes any kind of homosexuality.
Hmm. Very interesting. Another thing that came up in the book, I think in the boundaries chapter, was that sexual liberals, they would soon turn over the role of sex education to the schools, because they see it as something that they would be better at than we. Excuse me. That professionals can do a much better job than I can, and I'm too emotionally engaged, and I'm too old, and I don't know what I'm talking about. I thought that was very interesting.
I found it extremely interesting. And you know what that highlights in this book is that another one of the really remarkable differences between the sexual liberals and the sexual conservatives was about the education part of sex rather than the sex part of sex education. That it's about information. Conservatives want to control the information that comes into their families and that their kids get exposed to. And liberals, you know, they do have some worries about age-appropriate information, but they basically think the more information, the better. Conservatives think that the more information a young person gets, the more they'll become confused, the more they'll hear different views about things. Liberals think, well, yes, that's exactly the point. And one of the things that liberal parents said to me over and over again is, what I really, really, really like about sex education is that my young people, my children, will hear different views than what they've heard in the family, and then we can talk about it. So the value of sex education for liberals is that it starts conversations between parents and kids. The danger of sex education, as far as the conservatives are concerned, is that it starts conversations between parents and kids.
Yeah. There's a woman early in the book in Shady Grove that you introduce us to, Jenny, and she believes strongly that parents should be the ones teaching their children about sex and family. But Jenny also, you know, threw up her hands and said, but families are shirking this responsibility. So what does she do with that problem?
Well, she becomes involved in what's the fastest growing part of sex education in America, and that's the abstinence-only sex education. That's the sex education that's funded by the Bush administration. It teaches young people that the only acceptable form of sexuality for unmarried people is none. It's the sort of just say no vision of sexuality. It dwells on the risks and the dangers of contraception and sexually transmitted diseases and abortion. And it basically has, and this is to me very, very interesting, I can't think of another case in American public policy that fits this model. Often we have moralistic or morally based, I guess you'd say, public policies like prohibition or the war on drugs. And over time, people began to argue that they don't work and we should have a harm reduction model. That is, we should, rather than trying to prohibit it, we should try to help people who are going to engage in the behavior engage in it with the least cost to themselves and others. Sex education is one of the few cases that I know of that moved from the 1960s as a harm reduction model to the 1990s as a prohibition model. So abstinence education is a prohibition model. And so Jenny turned to these abstinence curricula, of which there are a great many, and began to lobby her school board to, you know, when she grudgingly accepted that there had to be some kind of sex education, or there was going to be some kind of sex education in Shady Grove, that they should employ an abstinence-only curriculum as opposed to a comprehensive sex education curriculum.
Hmm. Let's talk with a listener now, a caller in Champaign, Urbana, on line one. Good afternoon.
Hello. This is a very interesting program. Your guest earlier, I was very unclear on something. I was hoping she could expand on it. She talked about sexual conservatives having a lot of respect for hierarchy or expertise and said that that puts them in a kind of a funny position. I can't remember how she worded it, but I was wondering if she could expand a little on that. I didn't understand that.
Okay.
Yes, and I just mentioned it briefly, so you're right. Sexual conservatives are in a very interesting position in this debate, which is, in the end, their opposition is largely a religious one, that they believe it's morally wrong to have sex outside of marriage. And the source of that belief comes from their religious practice. Now, they're not all the same religion. And in fact, one of my colleagues at Princeton has shown that almost every American denomination is itself splintering into a liberal wing and a conservative wing, and the conservatives have more in common with each other across denominational lines than they have with the liberals in their own denomination. But they find the source of their belief that sexuality outside of marriage is wrong in the Bible. But being that we are a nominally secular society, and we are also a multicultural society, it's very difficult to go into the public schools and say, well, we can't have sex before marriage. We have to teach young people not to have sex before marriage because the Bible says it's wrong. So they end up making the plausible argument that the only 100% safe way to not get pregnant or not get a sexually transmitted disease is to not be sexually active. But then that puts them in this sort of murky realm of where values and expertise come together. So if you think as a value that people shouldn't have sex outside of marriage, then whatever risk contraception has or whatever risk of a sexually transmitted disease there may be, that's an unacceptable risk. If you think, as the liberals do, that sexuality is part of human life, that young people are going to experiment with it, well, then you weigh off the pleasures of sexuality and the pleasures of intimacy against the what for you is a relatively small risk that contraception will fail, or a relatively small risk, if you practice safer sex, that you'll be you'll have or contract a sexually transmitted disease. So expertise and values get all mixed up in these debates, and the two sides get apoplectic when they talk about each other because they're basing their numbers on their values.
Does the listener want to follow up?
No, thank you very much.
You're very welcome. Thank you for the call.
Celeste, I have a follow-up, if I may.
Certainly.
In one of Woody Allen's films, I think it's Play It Again, Sam. No, I think it's Annie Hall. You have a split screen where he and his girlfriend are seeing a therapist, and each of their therapists asks them, how often do you have sex? And the woman says, oh, constantly, 3 times a week. And Woody Allen says, never, 3 times a week. And I think that illustrates that the numbers are observed in the context of values.
Yeah. Is there any hope for, you know, bridging this huge divide?
Well, it's not the most powerful hope I can hold out, but it did occur to me that we could talk about what the controversy is going on underneath the facts and the values, which is this group of people, the conservatives, believe that marriage is the only legitimate and moral place to have sex. They also tend to assume that men and women are going to get married very young in life, that they're not going to go on to graduate school or professional school. And they believe that men and women have very different kinds of temperaments, where, shall we say, where women tend to find more happiness in families and men tend to find more happiness in the workplace. And then on the other side, here are these liberals that believe that men and women are substantially equal. They're not that different. They don't think people will get married pretty soon after high school. They expect that women in particular will spend some time finding out who they are and going to graduate school or having a bit of a career. And then, of course, yes, they will come to a happy family, we hope, but they'll come with experience and a sense of who they are, and that will make a better marriage. So if we put those core values out, then it seems that young people and parents can at least talk about those kinds of values rather than what's the failure rate of a condom. Mm. The other thing I suggested, and I've gotten some flack for it already, is that perhaps schools could offer both the flavors of sex education side by side, abstinence-only education and comprehensive, and that part of the conversation is not only what facts do these two kinds of sex education offer, but what kinds of values are they premised on? And then parents and young people can decide which is best for them.
Yeah. Why have you gotten flack for this idea?
I think people who are comprehensive sex educators worry that abstinence education, because it focuses on the failure rate and because it's a prohibition model, will get in the way of young people making healthy decisions. And there's actually some evidence that the good news is that students enrolled in an abstinence-only sex education course delay their first sexual experience by about 6 months. That doesn't sound like much, but multiply it across millions of teenagers, and it's a real reduction in risk. However, there's also some evidence that they're less likely to use contraception and less likely to know whether or not they've been exposed to a sexually transmitted disease.
Mm.
So it's a good news, bad news sort of outcome.
Yeah. What about, instead of two tracks, what about the possibility of a different focus depending on the age of the student?
I think we already have that. I saw in one community they had a comprehensive kindergarten through 12th grade sex education. And the sex education at kindergarten was very sweet and had nothing to do with sex. And one of the things I discovered in my research, this is where I started to say, by the way, is that you may well have had sex education when you were in third grade and you didn't know it. Because as I read over these curricula that got developed in the 30s and the 40s and the 50s, now remember I said family life education, mm-hmm, really bred in the bone of this early sex education. if you ever watched a chick hatch in class, or if you ever drew a little diagram with yourself and your family and your extended family and your community and your nation and your world all around you, you were engaged in activities that these early sex educators created as part of a sex education curriculum. If you watched little beans sprout in third grade. And basically, that's what kindergarten and first and second grade sex education looks like. And it's very sweet. It's not, I mean, it's, quote, sex education, but it's really family life education. And one wonderful kindergarten class that I watched was a teacher who brought in a torso with removable parts. And basically, the removable parts were about, these are your lungs, don't smoke, because if you ever have a baby, it'll be really bad for your baby to smoke. These are the breasts. Mommies breastfeed their babies. Some mommies can't, but it's always better if you can. You know, it was sort of very pro-family in the sort of old-fashioned sense of the word.
There we have to leave it. We're out of time. Really very interesting material. One last question.
Yes.
How good are people at articulating their feelings about sex and sexuality and sexual politics?
Well, let's just say it took me 20 years to decode it.
Very good. Thank you so much for talking with us this afternoon.
Oh, thank you for having me.
You're very welcome. Kristen Luker has been our guest in this portion of the program. She's the author, most recently, of When Sex Goes to School, Warring Views on Sex and Sex Education Since the 60s. The publisher is Norton.
And that was a program from the Afternoon Magazine archives from June 14th of this year. It's now 7 minutes before 2 o'clock Central Time on the Afternoon Magazine. And at this time every day, we take a look at settlement prices on the Board of Trade and the Chicago Mercantile Exchange. Board of Trade numbers up first, as well as some from Kansas City. Here to do that on this day of a pretty big sell-off in the grain market is Todd Gleason. Hi, Todd.
Oh, it was indeed very ugly on this crop report day. First, crop production estimates from USDA released for the corn and soybean crop this morning. And they came out a little larger, actually, on the corn than most had expected. At a 10.976 billion bushel crop, nearly 11 billion bushels, USDA is expecting corn farmers in the United States to harvest the average guess at a 10.795. So an 11 billion bushel estimate by USDA, the average guess about 10.8. And that pushed the corn market sharply lower, down anywhere between 11 and 14 cents for the day. That was most of the loss for the week. They were off about 20 cents week to week, Friday to Friday. The beans followed suit, despite the fact that they got a 2.928 billion bushel crop. Most were expecting that one to be up above